Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're going to talk about some women scientists, four of them to zero in on for you. There were four women scientists in Germany in the 20s and 30s who made significant discoveries in the field of physics. And then they were forced to flee Nazi Germany. And their stories, just incredible stories, are included in this fascinating new book written by Olivia Campbell, who is with us today. She's the author of Sisters in Science, How Four Women Physicists Escaped Nazi Germany and Made Scientific History. And as we talk with Olivia, I hope you'll join in. I want to hear from you. Are you maybe a woman with a career in science? What obstacles have you faced, maybe? Are you thankful for the women who overcame persecution and broke barriers decades ago? I hope you'll join in. Number to call is 1-800-642-1234. 800-642-1234, or you could send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Olivia Campbell, thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's great to be here.
I really enjoyed your book. Sobering at times, some high adventure in it at times for me. But in the end, it was hopeful for me in some ways. And I really appreciated your writing and the lives of these women. How did you come to write this book?
I read a piece in Smithsonian Magazine several years back about academics during the Nazi era and how, you know, they were called refugee academics. They were trying to flee the Nazis, you know, begging institutions to give them a job to sweep them, you know, out of harm's way. And I saw attached to that, the professor that wrote that piece was a project at Northeastern University, where they were gathering all sorts of data about women scientists and academics in particular. So I just digging through this archive of information, it was fabulous resource for me. Lists all the women who applied for grants, applied for money to try to escape Nazis, and whether they were successful in getting those grants or not, how that affected their ability to escape, whether they escaped or not. It talked about their languages they spoke. No, so there's this all kinds of information about the women academics in this data file here. And I'm digging through looking for a story. I'm thinking maybe I'll tell a story about one woman who survived and one woman who didn't survive the Holocaust, and maybe put those two against each other. But what I found was even more interesting and intriguing to me, which was I found these three women with H names, right? We had Hedwig, Herta, and Hildegard, the three main women in here. And they all were physicists. They all specialized in spectroscopy within physics. And they, not only that, they all knew each other, worked together, and found each other again once they came to America, worked together in America research. And then I find out that Lise Meitner, of course, the most well-known of these four women, she also knew these women, worked with them, helped them escape. They helped her escape. It was just an incredible story I had to tell.
It is an incredible story. Actually, in the beginning, you start the book in Germany in 1915, and I think another woman, Emmy Noether, who is really the creator of modern algebra, and she had to have faced many obstacles as a woman scientist in Germany, probably would have been anywhere at that point, no matter where she lived. But
she was a genius. She, I wanted to mention her as sort of like, she's a few years before these other four women come along, right? She's a mathematician. She's not a physicist, but she is just a genius. She's incredible, right? Einstein calls her a genius. Like that's the level of genius we're talking about. And yet she faced sexism in trying to get a job as a professor of math. And this, you know, her story really kind of sets the tone for the book, right? This is what we're up against right now. This is what women were facing at this time. So that I really liked her story as a way to kind of open the door.
If, you know, as I think about it, and as you wrote about, the 1910s to into the 1930s was kind of a golden age for sciences, particularly chemistry and physics. And Germany was the leader.
Yes, exactly. If you were a physicist in the 20s and early 30s, you had to speak German because that's the language of physics. Like that was what the findings were coming fast and furious, that Germany was the place to be if you were a physicist. And because of it was known as a hotbed of physics, it would attract more and more physicists, right, of a high level. So you have it just keeps building upon itself as this incredible center of research and findings, these research collectives and groups of people, you know, sparking ideas off each other and, you know, saying, well, if that's true, then let's look at that. This is true. And then building on findings, it was just an incredible time.
Yeah. Hedwig Cohn spent 20 years at, I think, the University of Breslau Physics Institute.
Yes.
And in 1933, she was forced to leave her position. And what was happening in Germany at that time?
So as soon as the Nazis came to power in January 1933, one of their first decrees was anyone who's Jewish or of Jewish descent is immediately fired from civil service. So almost every university in Germany at the time was considered a civil service job. So if you were a professor, a research assistant, like all the university jobs, you were out of a job if you were Jewish. So we have Hedwig and Lise, who are professors at this time, and they're both immediately fired. And for the other women, a lot of what happens for many other women in the country is they had a male supervisor who was Jewish who got fired. And that person was the person who was acting as their guarantor for their position. You know, the sexist administrators around them were saying, you know, we want this. We don't want this person here. We want them out. So they would have one person advocating for them. It's like, as long as I am here, you will have a job. That was the story for a lot of women. And so if any of those supervisors were Jewish, the male supervisor was gone, and suddenly the woman was subject to, oh, we didn't want you here in the first place, you're fired immediately. And it was very soon after that the Nazis really didn't want women in these positions of high-level academia or lawyers, doctors. They didn't want them in these high-level professions. So they really pushed women out of most of these professions later on anyway.
And Hedwig, she studied atomic spectroscopy. And by the way, I will say that all these women were in atomic physics, and I am not. Even though I have a pretty strong science background myself, I was really pleased at the way that you were able to describe the kind of work that they did, so that even I could understand it, to be honest.
I am also not a physicist by any stretch. I am not a scientist. I'm a writer. I'm a science journalist. I felt like it was a really great opportunity for me, as I was learning about what they were doing, to kind of explain it in the way that I learned it to my readers. I don't want this to be too dense. I don't want it to be, you know, turned off by this really dense science in the book. I don't want to talk down to people, but I also don't want it to be unapproachable. You know, I want to to be able to visualize what they were doing and try to understand as best as possible what they were trying to achieve and what they did achieve.
And what did she, in atomic spectroscopy, what was kind of an achievements, or what were some of the achievements for her?
So Hedwig had a patent with one of her students that she supervised. It was two women, which was fantastic. They patented this improvement of light bulbs. They improved the way light bulbs worked, basically. So she was, all her physics research was applicable to lighting technology, basically. So that's really what kept her alive between losing her job and finally escaping Germany, was that her research was useful to private industry. And so she was holed up in a little tiny lab in the back of her old workplace because they, you know, they wanted her to stay, but she worked for private organizations to help them with their lighting technology while she waited to be rescued.
And I think there was a former colleague of Hedwig's in America who tried to help her and other German scientists getting out of Germany. And it was dicey. It was hard.
There were so many letters. Like, all they could do was write letters. It was just letters upon letters, just like begging anyone they could think of, right? There's all these aid organizations that suddenly popped up, right, solely to help the people that are trying to escape the Nazis. And a lot of them were specifically for academics. Some of them were specifically for scientists. So, you know, it's just contacting, just reaching out to anyone you could think of. And then those people constantly reaching out to anyone they could think of to say, hey, do you have a job for this person? Hey, do you have money to help this person escape? And they were facing, well, first of all, there had to be in America or wherever else they went to, the institutions there had to be willing to employ a woman, right? So that was the first hurdle, was that half the colleges in America were interested in hiring women as professors anyway. So, it was a huge hurdle for them to find any sort of positions. They're mostly looking at women's colleges in the U.S. that would accept them. And even then, if they got a job, it didn't necessarily mean they had money. So a college might say, oh, we have a place for you. We can give you a room and board. You can teach some classes. We don't have any money to pay you. So that's where the grant organizations come in and say, okay, we have a few $1,000 to give you for the year to cover your, you know, your make some sort of money, make a living, right? So it was just so many pieces had to be fitting in, and they had, you know, visas to work on, and all these pieces to had to fall into place for success to happen, for you to survive.
And I think that was probably true of all four of the women you wrote about, in one way or another.
They were all like desperate to get out. There was no way that they could have a job, first of all, that they wanted in Germany anymore. And for the two Jewish women, there was no way they could safely remain in Germany, without being sent to a camp and facing internment. So they are just desperately reaching out to former colleagues, anyone that's already, you know, left the country successfully, which is mostly their male colleagues, male, you know, former colleagues that have gone to America, gone to other countries that, you know, hey, I worked with you a few years ago. What can you do to help me? I've got to get out.
Yeah. And she, I think she was the, Hedwig was the last to get out. And she was the oldest and had, I think, the most established, as you write about. And so it was difficult for her to leave until she got an ultimatum.
So Hedwig was the first German woman to get a physics degree, to a PhD. Lise Meitner had gotten her physics PhD in Austria. She was Austrian, and she had come to Germany shortly thereafter, after getting her degree, to continue her studies. So yes, we have Hedwig as the first, and then she's there left last, last woman standing, who's the physics professor, who's a woman. And it's really tight. She's really a few weeks away from being rounded up and deported to a camp. And she finally gets those visas all lined up and the jobs all lined up. And it's only because of the work of all, of her the other people I write about. We have Herta, we have Hildegard and Lise. They're all trying to help her get out and be safe.
And she gets out. I think you said it was in April she learns that if she's not out of the country by June 15th, she's going to a camp.
Yeah, it was, she knew. Like, you could see the tone of her letters sort of change then. She was my favorite character in the book, because she just has this indomitable spirit that, throughout this desperate time, she is just so hopeful. And you see a little bit when she hears that news that it's coming, that her letters are a little bit more like more resigned, but she's still hopeful. She's still hoping. And once she finally makes it to America, she's her spirit is still there. You know, they haven't squashed her spirit. She's just an incredible person.
She was indeed. Olivia Campbell, our guest today, her book, fascinating book, it's titled Sisters in Science. And the subtitle, How Four Women Physicists Escaped Nazi Germany and Made Scientific History. You can join in with your questions or comments. Love to hear from you. The number is 800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking today with Olivia Campbell, author of the book Sisters in Science, How Four Women Physicists Escaped Nazi Germany and Made Scientific History. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today. Questions or comments, I hope you'll join in, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. And there were some kind of historic barriers preventing women academics from enrolling or teaching at American universities, were there not?
There were a lot of universities in America at the time that still sort of had blanket policies that they just didn't hire women as professors. And there were some that sort of had an unspoken policy that they didn't hire women, right? They maybe had someone in charge of various departments who had decided that women were not a good fit, that women weren't going to, you know, be employed there. And so it was sort of an unspoken rule. And the letters from some of these administrators of colleges, I loved including those because they were just the reasons they're giving of like, oh, it's such a mistake to hire a woman. This, why are you doing this? This is, you know, the young men in college will never, you know, trust or respect a woman. It was just wild to hear these men rant about how terrible it would be to allow a woman in just because she was a woman, you know, totally ignoring how qualified and how intelligent and what a great professor they were, how long they'd been already teaching. You know, these were not young women. These were in their 40s and 50s by the time this was happening. And they had very well-established careers in Germany. They weren't like fresh out of college or something. You know, they knew their stuff and they had proven that. And the fact that these administrators would be so worried. And there was also this idea that they might be a spy, right? That they might be information gathering. So there's so many levels of what they had to dig through to find any kind of help in the way of a job.
Well, you think about it, and here is Germany, which is sort of the pinnacle for science, and especially in physics. And yet that wasn't enough, especially for women, as you point out. Now, people like Albert Einstein, James Franck, maybe these guys were able to easily get out. Everybody, you know, because they had names.
Yes, they were already Nobel laureates by this point. They were known. They were household names. They could go wherever they wanted, right? And if you look at I don't begrudge Frank his income, but if you look at his income compared to what the women are being offered, and they're in the same, you know, Lise Meitner and James Franck came up in the same exact time frame. You know, they were assistants at the same time. They got became supervisors around the same time. And if you look at what the women were offered for salaries compared to what he's earning, you know, it's half, it's a quarter. You know, it's really ridiculous. But yes, so many men were just plucked out right away. They could escape no problem. They were seen as a great catch, a great find, while the women were like, oh, you know, we don't want that. There's no way they could be as good as a man. There's no jobs for you here. It was really horrific.
Even at the science meetings, I noticed you wrote about smokers that they would have. So if there were women, of course, women and men were, at that time, it was considered not right for women and men to be smoking together. And so they would have smokers so that the women wouldn't show up.
It was just all these ways that they, yes, these unspoken, well, you can come, but we're, you know, not really. We don't really want you here. We're going to make it as unwelcoming as possible. So, yeah, that was the unspoken language. It was the cue for women, if it said smoker in the invitation, that they really weren't being invited.
You know, one of the things that caught my eye, sort of in a way a side note, you mentioned that physics was considered a subject study for women, not for men. Do you remember the thinking on that?
It was well before, you know, when physics first came along, it was sort of considered a more feminine thing. And that definitely, you know, for all the sciences, as soon as it became something that was like an official science that needed a degree, that, you know, was needed rigorous study, that's when it suddenly became a man's turf, right? So many sciences are that are considered, you know, okay for women, sort of feminine enough, like botany, being a nurse, those kinds of things. But yeah, when physics first appeared, it was, you know, oh, studying the natural world, well, that's women's stuff, you know, women can have that one. But yes, as soon as things become official and they realize what's all going on here, what's at stake, it's big, becomes the men's domain.
Habilitation, a requirement to teach at the university level in Germany required, I think it's called habilitation. Maybe explain what that was and how women were barred from pursuing it.
Yes, this was a huge deal. So Hedwig was the first, among the first, like all these women are around the same age. Lise is a little bit older, but Hedwig and Hertha Hildegard, those are among the first women who were officially allowed to get degrees in Germany. There were different states in Germany that allowed women to enter universities at different times, but the overall, these are the first women who were allowed. So, you know, they've been held back in that regard for a long time. So they finally allowed to get degrees. Okay. Well, what am I going to do with it? Well, I'm going to be a professor, so I'll apply to do a habilitation. Well, habilitation is basically a whole other thesis. So it's a huge paper. It's proof that not only you know your stuff, but that you could teach it as well. You know, this is it's very official. It's a big deal to be a professor in Germany at this time. And that was just another layer of women being kept out was for a long time. While you know, women have just been allowed to attend university. Well, I don't know about you, you know, being allowed to do the habilitation. So it was individual universities had their own rules about whether women were allowed or not. And I think some of the rules specifically said it was only men or used language that included the word men so that they would use that as a way to keep women out. But yes, there was a lot of anti-Semitism at universities at this time, and there was a lot of sexism, and then both of those things will work against women who were applying for habilitation. Didn't matter if they knew their stuff, didn't matter if they were going to be good professors, if they were Jewish, if they were women, no, they would get turned down.
Let's talk about Lise Meitner for, you know, I think it was 16 years before Hitler came to power. Lise Meitner had led a physics department at a German institution. Just talk about her.
Lisa's really incredible. She is definitely a trailblazer in this field. She's so tiny. She's about like 5 feet tall and she's very skinny. She's slight, you know, and I love to picture her like coming in front of a class and, you know, demanding the respect and attention that she deserves. She grew into it. I think she was very shy at first. But she became a really incredible professor. She was very particular. She had her lab, you know, just how she wanted it. But when she first came to Germany to research, they were, you know, the lab owner was like, I don't know if we should let you in. We had a woman in here before whose hair caught on fire. And, you know, she was like, okay, I promise to keep my hair back. And, you know, that won't be a big deal. So they only let her into the basement. So they create a workshop research space in the basement, her and Otto Hahn, her partner. So then She's not allowed to enter the institute through the regular doors. She has to go through the special back door to the basement only. There's no bathrooms in the basement. She has to go down the street to the restaurant to use the restroom. You know, this was ridiculous treatment for someone who has a physics PhD from University of Vienna. You know, it was ridiculous. So, but then she, you know, she works her way up and fights through sexism to eventually have her own, you know, section at the KWI, the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute for Physical Chemistry. So she's a physicist in this chemistry lab. And it's just a really, really incredible interdisciplinary research going on. You know, we've got chemists and the physicists, and it's really, really wild, incredible things coming up.
So, and her, I know in some of her research, I think she and Otto had developed a way to eradicate cancerous growths to begin with. From that was one thing that she did. It was amazing.
Yes, they discovered elements. They had practical applications for healthcare for what they were discovering for radiation. That helped to make them money and notoriety. And then, of course, it was her idea to begin the research project that eventually led to her discovering nuclear fission. But that was interrupted, of course, by her being forced to flee for her life. But she tried to continue that research with Otto via letters and at her new lab. And so that was a really fascinating back and forth of that.
That was just amazing. But she had a passport. So she thought, okay, I'll be able to get out. I've got my passport. But then Germany took over her country, and so then she no longer had a passport.
Right. So Germany annexed Austria. So her Austrian passport it meant nothing anymore. She had no passport. So she, you know, she's all set to leave. And suddenly she can't leave anymore. This is a story for many of these women. It's like they get everything lined up and then something happens. Like there's a new directive, there's a new law or something that's like, nope, no, you can't get out this time. Or, you know, I think war was declared for one of them. And so they couldn't escape this direction anymore. And, you know, it was one thing after another. So, yeah, she's like, oh, my gosh, I'm trapped here. You got the head of the Secret Service, like, looking into my case and what is going on.
And she got out, but it was difficult.
It was touch and go. She had like five men who were friends and colleagues, like plotting to how to get her out, right? Like, okay, we'll have this friend of hers like casually bump into her at the train station and like, oh, you're going the same way as I am, you know, like, and she could only pack like her suitcase for a very light, you know, summer vacation pack. Like she was going home to Austria for a visit. It will, you know, she had to leave most of her stuff behind. The Nazi police would look into your luggage. They would decide, you know, for Jewish people, if their luggage was high value, if they had anything they felt was important, they would just take it, or they would tax it heavily. Luckily, she didn't have any of those problems. But yeah, she just had like a few dollars, you know, and this light case, and she makes it over across the border on this train with her friend. It was. She was very worried, very nervous about that border crossing, but she made it.
But she had set up, as we talk about nuclear fission, she had worked for several years with Otto on this, and then really provided him through letters or correspondence the keys, the things that he was missing.
This was her project. So it had been about 4 years of research in the making. She initiated it and asked Otto to join. Otto was like the whole head of the KWI at this point. So he was like, I don't know if I'm going to have time to be part of this research project. I don't know. So she finally convinces him to join this research. And, you know, over several years, she's interpreting the findings with physics and he's interpreting the findings with chemistry. It's a really great matchup. And, you know, they finally get to this result where they can't explain it. Neither of them can explain it within the known laws of physics, right? They don't know what's happening. And I love this image that I borrowed from an article. I just couldn't think of a better image. It's shooting raisins at a cake, right? The shooting, so chipping a nuclear fission. So like, no one had expected that what would happen is it would break it in half, right? They would assume it would like break pieces off of it, not that it would split, right? It was just not thought of as possible. So when she finally figures out what this is, she names it Fission. You know, it's her realization. She's walking on vacation with her nephew, who's also a physicist. And it's just this real light bulb moment. It's fabulous. And she publishes a paper about it. And then Otto publishes his own paper about it. And of course, he's the one that gets the accolades. He gets the Nobel. She is, you know.
Not even mentioned.
No, he's at first he's like worried to connect her to it after she left because of what the Nazis might do to her, right? It's dangerous for her to be connected, to be still working on something with him. So, but even after that, even after it's safe again, he definitely does not give her the due that she is owed. He really downplays her role. And even the third person in their research group is like really upset with him. It's like, she did so much. Why are you being like this? Why are you doing this? And it really put a big fissure in their, you know, their friendship. They were, Otto and Lise were really great friends. And the fact that he kind of pushed her aside for her own research project and, you know, happily took all the accolades was kind of ended that friendship.
Yeah, it was really sad, but it led to the Manhattan Project. I mean, she brought us into the, you know, the atomic nuclear age, essentially. And the Manhattan Project was something she didn't like.
That's right. Her nephew did go to the Manhattan Project. Frank worked on it. There, you know, she had plenty of colleagues and friends working on it, and she was invited. And she said, absolutely not. She said, I have seen the horrors of war close up. She worked on the front as a nurse in World War I. And she said she would never be connected to anything that could create destruction of that level. She adamantly refused and said, you know, do not connect me in any way to this. And yet the newspaper still, you know, created these stories about how she was escaping Nazi Germany with an atomic bomb in her purse, you know, just really ridiculous images of her connection to it. And she really had no connection to the development of the bomb. And she was adamant about that. And she was interviewed several times about it after it happened, after they created the bomb and used it. And she was pretty upset by that.
Yeah, there was even a movie that they were producing, and there was she gained a lot of notoriety, but not necessarily the kind that she wanted. And there was a lot of falsehoods. Like there was a story about her carrying the nuclear bomb in her purse or something out of the country, out of Germany.
It was a lot. She really didn't like it. She hired lawyers in America and said, if anyone ever appears in a movie that even remotely looks anything like they might be based on me, you know, you sue the pants off them. You know, I do not want to be included in stories about the creation of this bomb. Because I didn't have anything to do with it. And I know there was a lot of talk about her not being included in Oppenheimer last year. And personally, I think, I mean, yes, it would have been great if she was mentioned as the discoverer of the whole reason that they were there. But I think she wouldn't have wanted to be, you know, included in this. Or I think it was correct that she would have disliked her being included in that story.
Yeah. Michael sent an email to say the book, while 6 million died, showed how immigration restrictions prevented many Jewish refugees from entering the U.S. How did these Jewish women scientists gain entry to the U.S. when so many other Jews were denied?
That is something I address in the book, the sort of eugenic basis. You know, we're talking about how eugenics are part of the Nazi ethos, right? But there is also this element of eugenics in how visas were being applied for in other countries, right? About how these women were considered more important because they were educated, because they had advanced degrees, because they had useful knowledge. So yes, there is a big element of, you know, acknowledging and recognizing the special treatment that academics were getting and when it came to whisking them out. That is not to say that there were a lot of scientists and academics who were killed in the Holocaust. There were, you know, not all of them made it out. But there were special types of visas for academics at this time. There were quotas, of course, for each different country. So only a certain number of people from Germany could come every year, a certain number of people from Austria, from Romania, all this, you know, had a quota for U.S. immigration. So it was, for a lot of people, they were like 6 years away from getting a visa once they got their name on that visa list, because they'd already accepted as many people from that country as we could in America. But yes, there was special academic and I think it was pastors, religious experts. Mm-hmm. They were in a special group that they could apply for this certain kind of visa that was sort of like a expedited visa for certain educated groups of people. So that's what most of these women were working with, was applying for these this academic visas.
And just kind of not only in the U.S. but elsewhere, you do write about even professors in other fields wind up actually taking any job they could just to get out.
It was, yes, this is a really interesting book that I had included some pieces of information from some sourcing about how, yes, there was like super high level professors working as like camp counselors or like a cleaner, you know, there's anything that would pay you money that would get you out of the country safely. They would accept it. You know, they had to take what they could get at that point if they wanted to get out.
Yeah. Olivia Campbell, our guest today, her book, Sisters in Science, How Four Women Physicists Escaped Nazi Germany and Made Scientific History. You can join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today as we talk with Olivia Campbell about her book, Sisters in Science, How Four Women Physicists Escaped Nazi Germany and Made Scientific History. Questions, you can join in. Number's 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. Let's go to Vern in eastern Eau Claire County. Vern, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, I appreciate you taking a call. Okay, so you're talking about these women in World War II that they say they invented fission. Well, actually, it was Leo Szilard, S-Z-I-L-A-R-D. He patented the fission reaction in 1933, and he's the one that sent the letter, signed the letter, made the letter out, and then Einstein signed it, and he sent it to Roosevelt. That started the Manhattan Project. Leo Szilard.
Do you know anything about Leo Szilard, Olivia?
He is in the book. Yeah, I mentioned that him begging the president not to go forward with the Manhattan Project, not to do this. But yes, it was definitely Otto Hahn and Lise Meitner who discovered the process of nuclear fission, and then Leo came in later. But yes, he was a big proponent against the use of this as a weapon, and entreated the president many times to think before he acted. But there was this big worry that Germany was also developing, you know, atomic warfare, was going to use this finding to create their own bomb. And of course, we know now, and they knew soon after, that Germany was nowhere near close to creating their own bomb. They had decimated their science programs, right? They had sent away all their best and brightest scientists because of their anti-Semitism. So they were nowhere near to creating a bomb of their own.
Yeah. Jonah in Green Bay, we'll go to you. Hi, Jonah.
Hi there.
What's on your mind?
So there's this ancient Mesopotamian woman scientist named, or her name was Tiputi Betekel, sorry, Bela Tekalim, a lot of syllables, Tiputi Bela Tekalim. She was one of the first chemists and certainly the first perfumist. And she's an obscure woman scientist figure that I know does not get enough attention in education. So I'm wondering if the guest knows anything about Tiputi.
That's a new one for me. I haven't heard of her. I've heard of, I've written about a couple of ancient women in science. I have a newsletter every month. I write a different biography of a woman scientist throughout history. It's called Beyond Curie. And yes, there's been a few that I found. The problem with really digging into these really ancient women is, what is there to read about them, right? Like I think if you're writing a book length thing, you could write about several women, right? But to find enough information about only one woman who's been, that age would be tricky. But yes, I love to write my little monthly newsletter, just those short articles about these women who are really overlooked, really underlooked at, and the amount of scientific work that was being done by women in these older times is just fascinating to me. Like before we had universities, before we had, these rules about who could study what and what was what. And when we had trades that were passed down through families, we had women taking over for their fathers in different ways. We had women who were taking over as professors in Italy and, teaching math and chemistry in ancient times. It was really fascinating. So yes, I would love to learn more about her for sure.
And just this whole business of recognition and remembering, as you well point out, I mean, Lise Meitner, I mean, people might know of her. I mean, she was nominated for 18 Nobels in chemistry, I think, as you point out, and 30 in physics, and never won a one. But
right, she is most she's known as being most famous for winning Anno Hahn a Nobel Prize. So it's ridiculous that she never won one. But if you look at the women who did, I think I mentioned this one woman who won a Nobel for physics in California, and the headlines read, "Local mother wins Nobel." The way that we treat women, the way we talk about them when they're doing the same things that men do is pretty ridiculous. But yes, I think Lise was much more famous in her time than she is now. Yeah. But she's of these four women, she was definitely the most well known for sure. She's had her own separate biographies published by several people. But I really like how I was able to sort of find this slice of time, right? I found, you may have heard of these women, but have you heard about this, tiny period of their lives where they all work together to achieve this one thing, or they all work together to help each other do this one thing? And so that's what I love writing about in my books is sort of bringing together people you might know, but the story about them that working together that you might not know.
Sharon in Berlin, Wisconsin, we'll go to you. Hi, Sharon.
Yeah, good morning. This is kind of interesting. I'm an old lady, and when I was younger, I was an assistant hall director to a lady named Eunice Bone, B-O-N-E. And she was hall director. We called her a house mother, She taught physics. She had a master's, I'm sure at least. She taught physics to World War II soldiers or some type of military. Her name was Eunice Bone, B-O-N-E. She was very famous as a hall director because she had a backbone, let me tell you. It's a very appropriate name. But I just thought I'd never heard of such a thing as a woman teaching physics for the Army or for whatever branch it was.
Oh, interesting. Well, Olivia?
So that's really fascinating to hear. I know Hertha, who landed at Duke University, talks a little bit about there's a period when they have like an accelerated program for people going in the military. So they're like, she's talking about how like how busy her schedule suddenly becomes when they're packing in these classes for these people that are going to be shipped out. And also the need for more people that know about physics from a military perspective, right? They need more scientists for the war effort, right? So these universities were ramping up programs to kind of speed these people through. And she talks about that being a real wild time in her tenure. So yeah, that's fascinating.
And Hertha and Hildegard, we haven't even talked about them, are really interesting people and great scientists. I guess we should have had 2 hours for the show. and Hertha worked with James Frank, actually wound up in the end, his wife died and they wound up getting married at some point. But she was almost tireless in her efforts to get the other women out.
She was incredible. She was not Jewish, but James Frank, her boss, was, and she felt very beholden to him that she also leave Germany when he left, and that, you know, her bosses fired her anyway, whether she wanted to stay or not. She escapes to Norway and finds a job there, and you know, the news is publishing like, oh, there's this German scientist has come to Norway, and so that kind of alerts Germany. She becomes an enemy of the state as far as Germany's concerned, and later on her sister is murdered by the Nazis because she's a part of the resistance. But she makes her way to Duke, to America, and to her Frank. Frank is already has been in America for a few years by this point. I'm pretty sure that she was in love with him for a very long time, but she, you know, would never do anything while he was married, of course. But yeah, she comes to Duke. She builds this awesome lab for herself. And as soon as she gets here, she turns around and starts helping these other women that are left behind, that are stuck, that are about to be deported. And she, like, just keeps pestering these neighboring universities, like, you're going to hire this woman, and I'm going to, you know, I'm not going to stop until you tell me that you're going to give this woman a job. And yes, she very likely played a very key role in keeping these women alive, and especially for Hedwig. She got this job at UNC, and for the, you know, the following year, like, she had these other two jobs for further out years, but she had got the job for her at UNC, like, right away. And that was really the key to pulling her out of Germany. So she also paid, like, she like I said, those women were not getting huge salaries, but she donated some of her salary to these relief funds for German scientists that were being popping up at this time. So she was incredible.
Yeah, she was indeed. And Hildegard, another incredible person. I think she wound up in Massachusetts primarily because of the contact that she'd made with Emma Carr, I think.
Right. So she had visited. She worked in Switzerland. She was at the university there, and even though she wasn't in Germany at the time, she was also getting fired because Switzerland was, like, really uneasy about having German immigrants staying there, and they were like, we don't know, we don't like what's going on, we're gonna send everybody back, it's not working out. And so Hildegard was like, I am not going back to Germany, that's not happening. She wouldn't have been able to find any kind of job at her level. She would definitely wouldn't have been a professor or even worked in a research capacity at a university as a woman anymore under the Nazis. So she sort of bypassed, went back to Germany, found this job because Emma Carr had come over from the U.S. for, you know, on a grant to study with her, and they got on really well. And so she was able to reach out to her and say, hey, can you help me escape, help me get out of here and get a real job. And it was okay at first, but, you know, it was a small women's college. She wasn't sure that it was really her cup of tea. It wasn't anything like a German university or a Swiss university, right? It was very small and very limited, and she couldn't specialize in her research like she really wanted to. So she reached out to Frank and Hertha and said, hey, can you help me find something else?
And you they helped her out. Well, there's so much more in your book that we haven't covered, but I want to thank you so much, Olivia, for writing the book and for being with us today. I really appreciate it, and I hope the book does well. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been fabulous.
Olivia Campbell, her book, Sisters in Science. It's take a look at this book. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News.